States versus Daniels.
Good morning, Your Honor. Eric Schwing for Susan Daniels. Good morning, counsel. With me today, Your Honors, is Mr. Holtzman on behalf of Dr. Gregory Daniels. Your Honor, this was a case that went to trial twice on two counts of filing false and fraudulent tax returns for tax years 1993 and 1994. We have brought two issues that we would like you to resolve on appeal. I believe both of them are reviewed de novo. The first issue is whether the Seventh Circuit requires a showing that a substantial tax deficiency exists in order to obtain a conviction. In this case, the issue came up in trial in context of a motion to dismiss the indictment. The district court ruled that that wasn't the law of the Seventh Circuit, citing a Supreme Court case called Sansone. The district court held that Sansone trumped the Seventh Circuit law set forth.
Mr. Schwing, could I just ask you something, please? Because you claim you didn't challenge substantiality at trial because the issue had been removed from the table before the trial even began. But clearly, you had an incentive at trial to challenge the amount of the tax deficiency. I mean, in the very least, the amount would affect sentencing, for example. In the end, it appears to have been about $28,000 for one tax year and $37,000 for the other. Can't we find now, as a matter of law, that these amounts demonstrated a substantial tax deficiency? And if so, wouldn't any error in the indictment on that point be harmless?
Well, Your Honor, as a matter of my personal view, I think they're substantial. They're substantial to me. You know, Warren Buffett might feel differently, or Bill Gates or somebody like that. The question is it a harmless error not to submit this, which we all hope is an element of the offense, to the grand jury?
Well, how could it be an element of the offense? Suppose I owe $50,000 in taxes, and I know it, and I deliberately report $49,900, because I've decided I don't want to pay that last $100, I want to cheat. Are you saying that I can't be prosecuted because the deficiency is not substantial?
I believe that's what the Seventh...
But that's ridiculous, because that creates a privilege to cheat, deliberately defraud the government of small amounts of money. And how could that be the law? That's completely senseless.
Well, I don't... You know, I don't think it's senseless, Your Honor, and I think there's some probably pretty good reasons for that law. One of them being the possibility of inadvertence or mistake.
Of course, you can't be prosecuted for inadvertence or mistake, but suppose you admit it's deliberate. I cheat, I always cheat $100 a year, I always cheat, because I have this safe harbor that the Seventh Circuit has given me. You can deliberately underpay your taxes by an insubstantial amount. That doesn't sound to me as if Congress would want to create that kind of exemption from liability for fraud.
Your Honor, I would readily concede there are things to be said on both sides.
No, I don't think there's anything to be said on your side.
As to whether this is a good law or a bad law?
How could it be good? I mean, it's like saying, you know, people should be able to steal small amounts of money.
Well,
that the law should only punish substantial crimes.
That's not the reason that I believe that this law is Seventh Circuit law. The Seventh Circuit law says there's a problem here proving intent. Willfulness is the issue here. And because
well, that might
that
be relevant to that, but suppose willfulness is conceded.
Well, it hasn't been conceded.
But suppose it were conceded. You would still argue that if, as long as it's a small amount of money, even acknowledged willfulness would not be a basis for punishment. That's your argument.
No, that's not my argument.
Yes, that's your argument, because if substantiality is an element, then the fact that your fraud is deliberate would still not enable you to be punished, because there would be no substantial fraud.
Well, that wasn't conceded in this case, Your Honor.
It's not a matter of... The question is, what's the logic of your argument? Do you really think substantiality is an element so that no matter how willful the fraud, it's not punishable unless the government proves that the amount of money defrauded is substantial?
I think that's what the Seventh Circuit has said.
But it doesn't make any sense, does it?
It doesn't make a lot of sense,
okay,
I don't think.
It doesn't make a lot. I'll settle for that.
I don't think it makes a lot of sense.
But if it doesn't make a lot of sense, why don't we change it?
Well, if somebody asked you to do that, I certainly think it would be within your prerogative to do that. But that hasn't been requested in this case. It hasn't been briefed and it hasn't been argued. This is a law that's been in, clearly repeated in the Seventh Circuit.
It's been working in a judicial opinion.
For about half a century now. The statute hasn't changed since that law was enacted. I don't know if there are any new facts that have come up since that statute has been enacted. Not only does the Seventh Circuit make that kind of holding, the Second Circuit does in reliance on this.
But no case says insubstantial frauds are not punishable.
Correct. Quite correct. But the majority of the circuits, in fact, every other circuit that's ever even addressed the issue, has said the government has to show a substantial tax deficiency in order to obtain a conviction. Seventh Circuit in reliance on the Seventh, Third, Fifth in reliance on the Seventh, Sixth.
No, but they've never confronted the issue. They've never said an insubstantial fraud is not punishable.
I agree. That has not been addressed.
This is stray language in the cases, maybe because the cases were cases in which substantiality was relevant to willfulness. As you say, if the amount of underpayment is insubstantial, that weakens an inference of willfulness. So that's probably all the courts meant.
Do you want to answer my question, whether or not any error in the indictment on the point would be harmless?
Your Honor, I think not, because if the indictment did require showing of substantiality, a couple of things have happened here. One of them being that there's substantial defenses disappeared. Now, the reason that, and we talked about this in the brief, that whole substantiality issue was off the table before anything got going, before a jury was selected, before opening statements were made, before witnesses were put on, examined or cross-examined, no closing argument. It was just gone. If substantiality is, as we contend, something that the government needs to show, then that's a burden of proof that they've been relieved with. There's a possibility of defenses that have been cut off, that whole line of defense was just abandoned in this trial.
So, but bottom line, it's your view that you did not have an incentive at trial to challenge the amount of the tax deficiency?
Correct. I think there was, if I was told at trial, I didn't try this case, if I was told at trial that this is not an element, doesn't have anything to do with anything, I would try to find more fruitful areas to go into in defense, other than something that the government is relieved of and it's not an element, and the court's told me it's just not a factor.
Yeah, but can we possibly fathom a fact situation which would support a defense on 2 years of income for two people that would find $65,000 as unless you want to challenge the amount, but under the so-called substantiality theory, Mr. Schwing, what would you possibly fashion here? What could be the insubstantiality of that amount in this particular factual setting?
Your Honor, the amounts were challenged at sentencing. And there was considerable discussion about where this money went and whether the money was checked that had
been... Take your best case on challenge. What would your challenges to be? Since you stay with challenge of sentencing, what number were the defendants prepared to acknowledge?
I couldn't say, Your Honor. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, perhaps you should move on to the other...
thank you, Your Honor. The second issue is whether essentially untimely indictment can save an untimely superseding indictment.
Was the government obliged to allege a date in which the fraudulent return was filed in the indictment? Were they obliged to allege a date?
No, Your Honor. They were not.
Then how were the Daniels harmed when the government alleged an incorrect date at first and then fixed it? I mean, weren't they on notice from the very beginning that it was the 1993 return that was at issue?
Your Honor, they were harmed because they were innocent of the defense, of the offense that was alleged in the initial indictment. What happened as alleged in indictment one didn't happen. There was no return filed. If I were defending somebody without indictment, going to court, put Madam Keller from XYZ Bank on the stand, was your bank robbed on April 15, 2003? No. Move for a directed verdict of acquittal, and that's the end of that story. So, yeah, they were harmed. They were told that they'd filed a fraudulent false tax return on April 15th. They didn't do that. That never happened. So, what did happen? When the magistrate judge said, this thing is on its face untimely, it's going to be dismissed, superseding indictment comes down the next day, very next day, that one's late as well. So, I don't think any court has ever addressed the issue whether an untimely indictment can save an untimely superseding indictment, but I think that there are an awful lot of reasons why the answer to that question ought to be no. There's no provision in any of the statutes that limit.
So every typographical error is fatal?
This is absolutely not a typographical error, and I know there's some hints in the government's brief about, you know, this was like a correcting the date of the offense. This was no typographical error, Your Honor.
What kind of error was it?
It was an error in the fact. The government alleged something that didn't happen. It's that kind of error. No, it's like saying you can all came in and robbed the First National Bank on August 15th, and no, I'm doing time in county jail on August 15th. I couldn't have done that. End of that story. We met 6 months later. You robbed the bank. I don't think that puts anybody on notice about what they're supposed to be defending against or what
they're supposed to be. But those indictments, of course, did deal with the 1993 tax return.
That's correct, Your Honor. But as an analogy, if there's a battery case where somebody beat somebody on August 15th and then turns around and beats them up again 6 months later, there's two separate offenses there. It's not one offense. Drug dealing, same kind of thing. Bank robbery, same kind of thing. The statute of limitations doesn't say anything at all about tolling, by the way. There's a special statute of limitations for tax cases.
Well, if the statute of if the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, can we find that the first indictment wasn't valid as a matter of law?
The statute of limitations, as I understand it, has to be raised as an affirmative defense. Once it's raised, the burden of proof shifts to the government to prove that the statute of limitations hasn't been exceeded. So, to the extent that it has to be raised by a defendant, yes, it's an affirmative defense, but my understanding is that the burden of proof on statute of limitations issues is with the prosecution. I'd like to briefly address the case that the government cited, United States versus Harvey, because it stands for exactly the opposite proposition that the government has cited it for. In that case, the Supreme Court was considering a tax code provision that says when you file something early, it's deemed filed on the date that it's due. The defendants in that case were charged with tax fraud. They wanted the late filing that they were charged with to relate back to the April 15th filing date that the original tax return was due on. The Supreme Court said absolutely not. That's exactly the proposition that the government is citing that case in support of in this case. So if there are no further questions, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my
time. All right. Thank you, Mr. Lane. Ms. Campbell?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Campbell. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I represent the United States in this matter. We ask the Court to affirm the defendant's convictions and the District Court's underlying orders for the reasons set forth in our brief. But I would like to address three matters. First, that substantiality is not an element of the offense of tax evasion. Second, even if it were an element, as Judge Rovner's questions have suggested, the omission would be harmless because it was uncontested and irrefutable that the defendant's tax deficiency for both the 1993 and 1994 tax years was substantial. And finally, the original indictment was timely, and so was the superseding indictment, because the superseding indictment charged the same offense as the original indictment. But let's first turn to the issue of whether substantiality is an element of the offense of tax evasion. The Supreme Court set this issue to rest, I suggest, almost 40 years ago in the Sansone case. There, the Supreme Court definitively set forth the elements of tax evasion, and as the Court no doubt well knows, I can tell from obviously from the Court's question, those elements are willfulness, the existence of a tax deficiency, and an affirmative act constituting an evasion or attempted evasion of the tax. This Court has never issued a holding that is in any way contrary to the Sansone case. In fact, since the Davenport case, upon which the Daniels really rely almost exclusively for this argument, this Court has had at least seven opportunities in reported decisions to set forth the elements of the offense of tax evasion. In none of those cases, since the Davenport case was decided, has this Court identified substantiality as an element of the offense of tax evasion. We set forth those seven cases at page 10 of our brief. They begin with Conley in 1987 and extend through King in 1997. There may be more cases, but these are the seven that we were able to identify. Additionally, the current Seventh Circuit jury instructions, as the Court no doubt appreciates, does not include substantiality in its statement of the elements of this offense. The only time that substantiality is mentioned in that jury instruction is in a committee comment that suggests that substantiality is an offense where the government employs a net worth theory of prosecution. But of course, in this case, the government used a specific items method to prove its case. So in no way does anything in the Seventh Circuit suggest, any holdings in the Seventh Circuit, any law of the Seventh Circuit, suggest that substantiality is an element of the offense. Judge Posner in his question suggested that it might just be essentially casual language in Daniels that injected this notion of substantiality in possibly into Seventh Circuit law, and the government would certainly agree with that view. Certainly, Davenport was not squarely presented with the issue of whether substantiality is or is not an element. The Court simply assumed that substantiality was an element in the context of the case, which of course was a challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence. There, Davenport, as the Court no doubt well knows, involved a tax protester who I believe filed a false W-4 and then did not file a return for at least one of the tax years at issue. And the question there was whether the evidence was sufficient to show that there was, in fact, you know, a substantial tax deficiency. There, the Court held that the $3,000 tax deficiency ultimately found was sufficient. So I think we can draw two lessons from Davenport. One is, it does not represent a holding. And we can draw that lesson from the fact that in the seven cases that have followed Davenport in this circuit, not one of those cases has cited Davenport for the proposition that substantiality is an element. And in fact, in all seven of those recitations of the elements of this offense, substantiality is not mentioned. Moreover, even if it were an element, Davenport would stand for the proposition, I suggest, that a $3,000 deficiency, which was that issue there, is sufficient. Because under the facts of that case, involving a challenge to sufficiency of the evidence, this Court actually did hold, that this was a holding, that a $3,000 deficiency was sufficient. So plainly here, the fact that there was at least a deficiency of that extent was not disputed and could not have been disputed. Closing arguments are obviously key to a case, and I would urge the court to take a look at pages 54, 55, and 78 of the closing argument. In his closing argument, defendant Greg Daniels pointed out, quote, "The government has made a big deal about how much this number is off. 138,000, 1993, 38%. That refers to the understatement of gross receipts by the defendants in 1993. He continues, "Same thing, 1994, off by 32%, $117,000. The defendants had no way to run from those arguments. They did not try to refute them. In fact, they tried to embrace them in closing argument by suggesting that the deficiency was so large that it would have been absurd for someone to try to evade that much in tax. His counsel continued, "To the contrary, the size of the discrepancy would seem to establish that these are people who weren't paying attention to what they were doing on their 93 and 94 returns, because this discrepancy is almost too obvious." At page 78, which includes a portion of Susan Daniels' closing, her counsel references the same thing. He basically concedes that there was a 38 or 32% error in both 93 and 94. And as Judge Rovner points out in her question, these defendants really had every incentive to try to minimize this number. Obviously, the size of the number could go to the issue of willfulness. You know, a smaller, if one is off by just a little bit, one might be able to argue this was not willful, this was a mistake. So the defendants, that certainly would have been a better argument, I suggest, for the defendants to make. But they couldn't do it because the numbers here were irrefutable. And indeed, at sentencing, the court asked the question of whether the defendants would have had an incentive to minimize their tax liability, at least for sentencing purposes, and certainly that was the case. The defendants gave it their best shot. And at sentencing, and this is attached to the PSR, the defendants submitted a tax calculation. And even in their calculation, the defendants conceded that their total additional tax owed was over $29,000 in 1993 and over $40,000 in 1994. And that's when one omits some of the understated cash receipts that the defendants tried to have the court toss out. So even under the facts viewed in a light most favorable to the defendants, the tax liability well exceeded by a factor of 10 the $3,000 figure found, you know, substantial in Davenport. So I suggest, Your Honors, that substantiality is not an element of the offense, and even if it were, it's not an issue here. Any such error would be harmless. I'd now like to turn to the last issue, and that is whether the government's original indictment was timely and whether the superseding indictment relates back to that indictment. Both in the Habig case, the Supreme Court case cited in our brief, and in a case from this circuit from the 1950s, the Yeoman-Henderson case, this court and the Supreme Court have held that the crime of tax evasion, where it's committed by the filing of a false tax return, begins running on the date the false return is filed. And that's certainly true where the taxpayers have gotten an extension beyond April 15 to file their return. In this case, there is no debate that the Daniels filed their joint 93 tax return on October 15, 1994. Nor is there any dispute about when the original indictment was returned. That was returned within 6 years on September 26, 2000. So plainly, the original indictment was timely, and it was brought within a six-year limitations period. The superseding indictment relates back to it for the simple reason that it charges the same offense. I think that the analogy that appellant's counsel offered about a battery case is really off point. We heard the example of, well, gee, perhaps the erroneous date in the original indictment could have confused the defendant. I suggest that couldn't happen here. This is different from a battery case. If you had a serial battery, you know, want to engage in serial battery, this could be a problem. But typically, people pay their tax and file their tax return once in a given year. The original indictment charged the defendants with trying to evade their 1993 tax obligations by filing a false 1040 in 1994. The defendants did that one time, and there can be no dispute about that. So the original indictment fully well put them on notice that they were going to be held to account for their fraudulent tax return for the 1993 tax year that they filed in 1994. Unfortunately, the government got the date wrong the first time we got an indictment from the grand jury. But we got the right date on the superseding indictment, so the superseding indictment should relate back, and the defendants cannot, nor have they even tried to, offer any persuasive reason as to how they might have been confused by the original indictment. So for these reasons, Your Honors, I suggest that the superseding indictment should relate back, and there's no issue at all as to whether this indictment was timely. So for all these reasons, we would ask the court to affirm the district court's orders and the defendant's conviction. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Mr. Swing?
Thank you, Your Honor. You know, there are an infinite number of ways to violate the tax statute. It doesn't, the only offense isn't filing a false and fraudulent tax return. Almost anything that a person can do that's fraudulent and intended to evade taxes is a violation of the statute. So I think it's a little glib to say there's only one way you can violate the statute, one, and everybody files a tax return once a year, so nobody has any clue about what other offenses could possibly have been referred to in this case. The question about whether that first indictment was timely has already been answered, and been answered clearly. It was untimely on its face. That's what the magistrate ruled. That's what the district court was about to rule, and nobody objected to it. And that's the way that came down. It was untimely. So the suggestion that the first indictment was timely is not supported by the record nor by the holdings of the court. Court has any other questions, I can answer them. Otherwise, thanks very much.
Thank you, the other counsel, and thanks, Mr. Campbell. Case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed.